Welcome to Idle Red Hands, a podcast from Japan about gaming and gamer life. And welcome to Idle Red Hands. I'm Chris.
I'm Wayne.
I'm Lyle. So we finally watched Falling Skies. It's not bad. People don't know. It's aliens invade the Earth, and it kind of tells the story of the survivor set in Massachusetts. Well, they certainly...
Massachusetts? Yeah. Huh. So I'm imagining lots of kind of pine forests and, well, out of the city.
Small town?
No trees?
I've only been to Boston, so that's my entire image of Massachusetts. Hmm. Is it got a lot of trees?
It's kind of like up, you know, northeast, where I imagine there's a lot of pine forests. Apparently not.
Yeah, and they're all the right height. And it's good.
So I guess there's no trees in Falling Skies.
There are trees.
Where did this come from?
What is this?
What are we doing?
sorry, hold on about the alien. Look at that. Can we talk about trees? Believe it or not, not one plot has revolved around the
trees. That's why I quit watching Star Trek, you know, just not enough trees.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, it's not bad. Pretty decent cast. They're on a budget, so you see the aliens a little, not a lot. Then they have a interesting mystery, which is, or not necessarily a mystery, but I guess a problem. Oh, the aliens invaded the Earth. actually, I meant a different.
Apart from that, they have a problem.
And the laughs ensue.
No, they've kidnapped all these kids and put harnesses on them. I guess they kind of get these harnesses. So initial dilemma is how to get these harnesses off.
Interesting.
Yeah, no, it is pretty good. Yeah, but not as good as Suit. Which I also just started watching, which is probably has nothing to do with gaming, but it's a lawyer drama, comedy drama, and the premise is there's like a hotshot lawyer, and he hires this kind of smart, good-for-nothing guy, and gets him to say he's from Harvard to work at the law. Huh. And hilarity ensues.
Hilarity ensues. Yeah, yeah. Hmm. I was waiting for Chris to pipe up with that one.
Ah, sorry. I thought once was enough.
In New York, so not a lot of...
All right.
Well, that's it. I'm not watching it then.
And finally, I had a pretty good weekend, actually, and I watched Taken.
Liam Neeson movie.
Yeah. Yeah. And just because of the phone call meme, you know, it's like, I will find you, and I will kill you. Yeah. In Japan, it's called 96 hours, because, well, that's how long it takes. The problem.
To watch. No, that's actually one of my favorite Liam Neeson movies. I really like that one.
Oh, you have seen Taken?
Yes, I have.
When did you have time to see that?
It was a long time ago. I saw it in the theater when it first came out here, but I actually went and saw it drunk with a couple of friends. And it was just fun to watch Liam Neeson plow through France, fists swinging. It was great.
Yeah, he's a one-man wrecking machine.
It is.
I'm just imagining Chris plowing through that movie theater drunk with his fists.
I was trying to do that on my way out.
Yeah, probably. I'm Liam Neeson.
Yeah, it's okay. I prefer something more like 24. I was kind of thinking like who would win, Jack Bauer or Liam Neeson.
Isn't that like the ultimate nerd test when you stack two fictional characters up and decide who would win?
Maybe.
Then again, there is fantasy football, so.
Yeah.
Yeah, but that's with little players.
Anyway.
Fantasy football?
Isn't this like a podcast game?
Pardon me for trying to inject a little testosterone into the cast.
I was the one that watched Taken, not you, dude.
All right.
Didn't you just finish reading the second Hunger Games book?
I didn't finish it yet.
Ooh. How's Gossip Girl going?
Yeah, exactly.
All right. I didn't mean possibly for the entire run, just right then, all right?
Yeah, so I definitely strongly recommend Taken and Suits, and I recommend for Falling Skies. That's pretty good.
Sorry, I wanted to ask about Falling Skies, because you said you don't see the aliens that often because of budget reasons, but like I'm wondering, is it noticeable that it's because of budget reasons, or is it more, you know, have they worked it into the story well enough where you don't really need to see them?
Within this each story, it doesn't seem to matter all that much. The only thing is, like, why aren't there more aliens around?
Hmm.
Why do they travel in packs of one and two? You don't see a lot of the other ones, so. Right. You see about one alien an episode, maybe.
Hmm.
Yeah, and this thing, because like sometimes you can really tell when a show is suffering from budget restrictions, and then other times you kind of don't really know. And then, you know, later on you find out, oh, you know, they were working on a shoestring budget. You know, I wouldn't have known they worked really well with what they have.
So, are they CG or dudes in costumes?
Or is it one of those shaky cams so you can't tell?
I think mostly dudes in costumes.
Hmm.
At least when they do up close where you see, like a face.
Mm-hmm.
The mechs, I believe, are CG.
Hmm. Oh, okay.
Ooh, mechs.
Yeah.
I'm more interested now.
Yeah, and you don't see a lot of those in one shot.
Less interested.
Sounds good.
Yeah, let's check it out. So in gaming news, we got a review copy of Champions Complete from Hero Games.
Yeah.
And we should say we just got it today. So I started to look through it because I played Champions before, like way back when,
mm-hmm.
in high school. Wow.
Yeah, you said way back when already. We got it.
And yeah, it looks pretty good in the brief look I had, but hopefully we get to run at least a game or two next month, give a proper review.
Yeah, looking forward to that.
Yeah, that brief look you gave it, Lyle, is a brief look more than I was able to give it so far. So I imagine, since this is Champions Complete, and the blurb said that they tried to streamline this product and put stuff in there, I'm imagining it will probably be somewhat more simple than the full-blown Champions book, but I could be wrong about that. I don't know.
I don't know. Yeah, it looks... I started to go through. There's different types of costs. So they've already divided the point cost into three different types. So I was like, okay, that's already more difficult than most other point buy systems.
Oh, you mean like different categories of cost? Like
yeah, like real cost, active cost. And So, so I can see people... Yeah, I mean, the explanation is clear what it is, but just the fact that they had... They're referring to the three different types of costs. You're like, okay.
Right.
But, you know, how this... We'll see. You know, it's just... Well, it's a lot like GURPS in that you can... You pick your powers and then you build upon those.
Right.
Through the points, so... Which gives you a lot of flexibility, but, yeah, the more flexibility, the more complexity, so...
Like GURPS, it sounds like a game where you have to go into character creation with a concept clearly in mind because they give you the ability to create anything and everything.
Yeah, and this was the system that kind of got people thinking about concepts like Brick and that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and started to like classify the superheroes so that people could make their characters. And, you know, again, in my brief look, they've still kept to that. They've got like the Brick, and then they break down the Brick into some very common types. Including the aquatic Brick, which a lot of people might not think of
aquatic
until...
Brick.
Well, then you go Neymar, and you're like, oh, yeah, that's right, yeah.
Hmm.
You know, because you live under the water, and it gives you more strength and constitution or whatever, like defenses to avoid being crushed.
I actually don't know that much about Neymar. I was thinking more about Aquaman, and all he did was talk to fish, so...
Yeah, I don't know a lot about Aquaman either. They keep trying to revive him.
Except the fact I think he's not a Brick.
Yeah, well, Neymar was, like, kind of a heavy hitter. But I was just thinking it's kind of odd that, but I wonder how it's going to do, because right now there's viable licensed products in Marvel and DC.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Plus there's a couple of the, we'll say, more generic systems out there. There's GURPS, but I don't think their GURPS supers ever really took off.
Mm-hmm. Right.
In all its incarnations. And then there's Mutants and Masterminds, which has taken off.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, it's kind of hard to compare those games. Or at least hard to compare like some like Champions with Marvel, because Marvel is such a different system.
Yeah, it is. Eh?
And as you said, like DC has what? They're part of Mutants and Masterminds, aren't they?
It's by Green Ronin, but yes.
But, I mean, they're kind of like
it's similar.
It's DC heroes plugged into kind of an existing superhero framework, but like again, I can see how maybe Champions would appeal to someone who wants to create their own superheroes, because that's one thing you can't do with Marvel. I mean, you can, but it's kind of built to play the Marvel characters. And I imagine that DC is kind of the same way, like it's built to play the DC characters, because let's face it, you pick up Marvel or DC, it's because you want to play in that universe.
Yeah, but Mutants and Masterminds, you build your own character.
Oh, yeah. I wasn't saying...
Same for GURPS Super Saiyan.
Yeah, I wasn't saying it was everything we had listed before, just those two big ones, so...
Sounds interesting. Can't wait.
All right, well, yeah, well, that's got a couple games to look forward to next month. So, all right, so now we move on to part two of Swords. So the first in our weapon series. And what we're going to focus on this episode is, we've already laid the foundation of what the role of society, the role on the battlefield. Now we're going to talk about the role in your game.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll start off with the actual sword itself, and then we'll move on to the hand that holds the sword, or the sword master. And this is something that we talked about off mic, and it's just, I guess a frustration when we look at the sword and the stats that you find. Of course, you know, they're going to give the short sword, it has less damage than the long sword, which has less damage than the bastard sword, and so on and so forth. But I'm sure it's not news to anybody, like, but listening to last episode, you realize that these kind of swords didn't exist in the same time period, and or had different roles, and were dealing with different armor.
Mm-hmm.
But the standard D&D or the standard fantasy setting kind of defaults to like high medieval.
Right.
So you're looking at, you may as well just take the biggest sword you can get, wear the most armor you can, because those give you the best numbers. So somebody who wants to play with a Roman or a Greek style hero in this kind of world, and not just a strictly Greek or Roman world, is at a disadvantage, because it doesn't matter if the great heroes like Achilles and Hector or real generals like Julius Caesar use this type of weapon, you know. Aragorn used this. Alright.
No.
Actually, I think it makes them all the more impressive. Like, you crack open one of those, like, D&D books, and you're like, man, Achilles was a great hero. And he did that with a D6 short sword. Wow, yeah. Holy crap. He must have been amazing. But, no, I think some games do address it a little bit, and after playing D&D next, D&D is one of the games that kind of tries to do it a little bit in, sometimes you have the different classifications of weapons where one you can use your strength attribute and one you can use your dexterity attribute. Mm-hmm. And at least in D&D Next, short swords are a finesse weapon, which means you can substitute your dexterity for it. So you can kind of differentiate them a little bit, but not a whole lot. And in my opinion, that still doesn't make up for the minuscule kind of, you know, D6 damage dice, where the arming sword, or in D&D terms, the long sword, or, you know, the bastard sword, or great sword, have much higher damage dice, where, as you said, Lila, you just can't really compete with that.
Yeah, and other systems, like Song of Ice and Fire role-playing, where you make a lot of use of keywords for the weapons, I think that's good as well. Like, for example, like, great sword might have powerful, slow, handed, unwieldy, vicious, and vicious is truly a vicious ability.
Right.
But a small sword would have fast.
Mm-hmm.
And it has a different specialty.
That's all it gets fast, and it's kind of unbalanced.
Yeah, you can't use a shield. Would you stop?
I just thought it was funny. You rattled off like 9 keywords for the great sword, then, oh, and this one has fast.
All of them are good, though. Unwieldy and slow aren't good keywords.
Mm.
And those who aren't familiar with the Song of Ice and Fire role-playing, they combine attributes and skills into a thing called abilities,
mm-hmm.
which sound like skills.
It's very similar to a Fate system, if anyone's tried that.
Yeah, so those are linked to, like, weapons are linked to different abilities, which is similar to what Wayne was talking about with D&D.
I think that of the different kinds of systems that have ways of handling different weapons, I think that's one of the most elegant. But, I mean, it's no secret I'm a big fan of the Fate system to begin with, but those keywords are great. But there's a few systems out there that do allow you to play around with the different kinds of weapons because they kind of attach what kind of moves you can do to it. For example, GURPS or Fading Suns or World of Darkness, they all have fencing or like sword skill kinds of abilities that you can use different kind of maneuvers with the swords with. So you can bring out the differences in swords and the way that those maneuvers interact with them. But yeah, again, D&D doesn't.
Yeah, that's definitely one way to do it. Like, the ubiquity setting, that horror musketeer mashup all for one.
Mm-hmm.
In a supplement, they came out with fencing schools. You know, they had about like 10 or 12 of these different fencing schools, and each different fencing school came with a bunch of different moves you could do where they described, you know, what that school focused on. And you would get modifiers when you were fighting against someone from a different fencing school. Fencing School A was different than Fencing School B, and you'd get bonus when you were fencing against, you know, someone who followed that tradition. But then you would get, like, a penalty when you were fencing against someone of a different school. I'd seen that in other systems where they kind of tried to make, like, a kung fu thing, you know, kind of a rock, scissor, paper thing, where mm-hmm. you're better but worse against other ones. And I think that's a pretty decent way to do it, and that's only with just one sword, the rapier.
Yeah, I mean, I like the idea of that, where if you have a system that allows you to do a thrust move, then perhaps a sword like Gladius would be better. But at the same time, I don't think that I'd actually want to add that many layers of rules onto my game.
I think fighting is not adding too many layers, really.
I think if you have to compare two schools, it sounds like you're going to be looking it up on a chart. I don't like looking up charts. But I suppose that's just my own bias.
No, if you have the fighting schools as like sets of packages,
mm-hmm.
and or abilities and that, and it would be the game designers, the onus on the game designers to create balanced schools. So like somebody with a sword is on par with somebody with a bastard sword because they're different style of fighting. Now, that said, I'm talking about a world where we're mixing all of the different sword types.
Yeah.
So like in that Musketeers that Wayne was talking about, of course you would just do the fencing schools and they would all be using like variations of the rapier.
Right.
But I think you can extend that and like, let's see, like somebody who does fight with a Greek heroic style using the weapons of a Greek sword fighter, they would be able to match a knight, fair or not fair, you know.
Do you think this would, you could just transpose the weapons? So for example, if you have the medieval base that D&D does, where you have the short sword, long sword, etc. Could you just kind of move everything over and give it a different name for, say, a Greek version or a Roman version? So the short sword would become a gladius and a long sword would become a spatha.
Yeah, I was thinking for the Romans. For the Greeks, I'm not sure, because their swords were all wouldn't be equivalent. They would be equivalent to a short sword and kind of a, I don't know.
Scimitar, I suppose, almost?
Kind of like a scimitar, yeah. Or even just like an axe.
Yeah,
the coppice maybe would be more of an axe.
Well, because I was looking at the Chinese swords, like the Jian and the Dao and such, and it's almost, they are shaped different from European swords, but they pretty much all have the same roles.
To cut things? Yeah.
Yes.
Well, I was thinking, like, if you kind of like transpose, I guess, you know, the swords to like a different culture, as you said, you know, kind of what would be the analog of an arming sword if you're doing a Greek or a Roman style game. Like, couldn't you just say, well, if there is no analog, if it didn't really exist, then it doesn't exist? You know, like if the Greeks didn't have what would be the equivalent of a long sword or an arming sword, then yeah, sorry, you just can't pick it. It's not there. It doesn't exist in that culture.
I mean, that works great if you're only doing it reductionist, if you're only taking away swords. But what if you are doing something like Greek where you have the coppice, which is pretty much like a big axe that's sharp all along the way? Do you create a new sword for that? And do you make up the rules for that?
Well, I know we're doing swords, but I think you could just reskin an axe and call it the coppice, you know?
Yeah. And when it gets down to it, you know, we're only talking about a difference of a die type, so it's not that big a deal.
Yeah, so it only really comes into play when you're doing cross genre.
Yeah.
Like when you want your Hector to be able to stand against the Lancelot.
Mm-hmm.
Because in traditional fantasy, everybody would just go, well, just everybody be Lancelot.
Right. Yeah.
Because the systems often don't take into account, you know, that Lancelot, kind of the peak of his culture, or his mythical culture, where Hector, well, he wasn't the peak, I guess that would be Achilles, peak of his mythical culture.
Right.
Yeah. Of course, Achilles being invulnerable might help him in that.
Yeah, I was going to say, Achilles might take Lancelot, but...
I don't know. If Lancelot could aim that, you know, lance to his tendon, then game over. Well, what do you guys think about, like, I know we're talking about swords, but what about adjusting the armor? Because the other thing that Dungeons & Dragons and other games have is they have the kind of attack type, where I think they have, like, slashing, piercing, and bludgeoning. And certain types of armor protect you better against certain types of attacks. So, like, if you really wanted to emphasize the stabbing power of the gladius, then couldn't you, you know, say it does this additional damage against armor, or it ignores this much armor, or it does this much in extra hit points? I guess we're kind of getting into keyword territory like Song of Ice and Fire does, you know, where, you know, you lose this many hit points because you now have this, you know, nasty gut wound that you just got.
Yeah. Hey, I think that's a great way of going about it. And that's actually what I was referring to earlier when I said different maneuvers. If you have a system that allows you to do a thrust maneuver specifically, you could give yourself a bonus if you're using something like a gladius or a dagger or whatnot. But yeah, I mean, putting it with the armor, that is great. And they do have that in D&D Next, the damage types, though I haven't seen any rules about how to use them yet.
I've seen that on monsters. I mean, the classic thing is skeletons. You know, piercing damage does pretty much nothing against skeletons.
Oh, yeah, there is that. I haven't seen it on the armor.
I don't think they have it yet. They might come in one of the, like, optional rules modules. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, games like GURPS and that, they would have, like, thrusting and different types of damage that they can do.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, unfortunately, like, people don't like that added level of complexity.
Right.
Yeah, I think I'd skip over it, too, to be honest.
It's actually going in the opposite direction of where games are going.
Mm-hmm.
Like, adding the complexity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't know. I guess ways around it with the armor is, I guess, really hindering maneuverability or even more. I mean, that's a pretty simple number to work in. But I guess you would have to have a system that does allow people to parry or dodge.
Mm-hmm.
And some systems do have that.
Yeah, I think GURPS does, right? Active defense.
Yeah, so like World of Darkness could do it as well. But a game like D&D where everything is like when you combine dexterity and armor class into one number,
right?
It's very hard to separate those out.
Yeah, I think for a game like D&D that does kind of make, you know, lump it all together, like this is how difficult you are to damage with that armor class, then you would probably have to do something to the damage that the weapon does. Like I said before, like that extra hit point loss due to bleeding now because you got stabbed, or, you know, you have like a huge gash on you now.
If you want to do it in D&D, maybe you could, on a critical, give each sword a different kind of effect. You know, a katana lops off a limb, or a short sword or gladius inflicts a nasty stomach wound or something like that. That'd be fun.
Didn't 3.5 do that? Like, the criticals weren't all on a 20. Like, there was a different threat range. Like, I remember scimitars had, like, they got, like, a critical on, like, an 18, 19, or 20. And
yes.
Then they had that damage multiplier where, you know, some things were just, like, absolutely huge, where other things were pretty, pretty minor.
Yeah, there were a few, there were wider crit ranges for certain weapons, again, like the scimitar. They're ones that had extra bonuses on the crit damage.
Interesting. There were some feats that increased that threat range.
Yes.
For critical. Because I remember those were always awesome feats. So, It's not exactly a maneuver, but it is kind of a way to, you know, say, okay, you have training in this kind of weapon, which means you can kind of do this thing. I butchered that point terribly. Wow.
It's getting pretty abstract to do the numbers like that. Again, I'd prefer to, if you have this training, you can do some kind of special maneuver which pairs well with certain weapons or not.
Oh, you could do it that way. Like, you know, you take this feat and, hey, when you use a weapon that does stabbing damage, it does something else, you know.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, take that. This feat gives you a +6 bonus with weapons that have the keyword stabbing or piercing or something like that.
Another thing you could do is, this gets back to the armor, but one thing is, like, I guess we're defaulting to the D&D system, but is that with the dexterity, I mean, you already have to be, like, super fast, and armor just starts, it never really adds a penalty, it just kind of says you get, like, it limits the maximum.
Right.
But then, you could do it with the armor where maybe they give you a bonus in combat, or at least you start to have the penalties come up a little bit sooner.
So you're kind of talking about, like, tracking endurance.
Or dexterity. Like, somebody who's wearing a breastplate and greaves is going to be able to move a little bit easier. But then, that's not really that true. It's the hoplites who are wearing heavy armor, and they had trouble running.
Yeah, and if you're well trained, I mean, remember we were talking about knights and samurai, about how knights could do backflips in their armor and things like that, versus somebody who's untrained but wearing a breastplate.
So that's the actual sword itself. So, but what about the person who uses a sword? And I mean, what makes a sword master? And what, you know, how does that person's choice in weaponry, like, influence who they are? How you can allow it to help shape your character?
Mm-hmm.
Now, I guess the standard be like somebody who's a rapier is going to be a swashbuckler and therefore is going to be talkative.
Have the big hat with the feather.
That too. Yeah. Yeah.
Thigh boots with the turned over cuffs.
Like, a lot.
Yeah. Swing on chandeliers. Yeah, we got it.
Exactly.
Yeah, but then once you get into like what makes a two-handed sword fighter? Like
size. Sorry.
Yeah, size matters. Yeah. But why are they using that sword instead of a rapier? Why, or instead of a arming sword or long sword?
Right.
And is it more than just, well, I don't think I need a shield, so I want to dish out a lot of damage. And unfortunately, sometimes when you read the suggestions on what to take, that's kind of what they recommend. It's like, yeah, take this feat, with this sword, because then you can deal the maximum amount of damage, you know. But what does that say about you as a character?
Yeah, exactly.
It says you're a bunch of numbers on a piece of paper.
Yeah. With penis envy.
All right. Not if you're using a short sword.
Yeah, it's a long sword, yeah. You obviously have issues.
This guy's got a short sword. He's got confidence. The rogues go to bed a lot. Yeah, you know, I think if you compare it to real life, I think the choice of sword is very rarely a choice in the way it really is. It depends on what your position in whatever kind of military is, or if it was handed down to you from your family, or if it's some kind of ceremonial blade that you keep. I think it's very rare that you get to choose what weapon you use.
You mean in real life?
In real life, yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Which is completely different from the way that games are set up. So it's definitely something that you can use to try and define how your character is. You know, if you start off with a longsword, well, why is it a longsword? In history, that would mean that you're probably a properly trained knight or a fighter, or that you've received it from, as a family heirloom or something like that. It would have backstory. It would have history.
Yeah, I think that's kind of the place to start. Like, most games, especially in like the fantasy genre, they give you, you know, a lump sum for your starting character to buy equipment with. And generally, you try and buy, like, the best equipment you can and the most damaging. But what if you looked at it from the real-life perspective and say, okay, and where does my character come from? Mm-hmm. What kind of weapon would they have, and what does that say about them? And I think, again, that's something that the player and the GM would have to work together, because you can't really make that choice in a vacuum. Like, you would have to know something about the world, or even if you kind of, you, the player, make a little bit about the village or the culture you came from, then that would inform your decision. And I forget where I read this, but it was related to guns. And I know we're not talking about guns in this episode, but in that setting, guns were the mark of a coward because, you know, it was considered very dishonorable to kill someone sort of from range. And so the little blurb said, if you pick a gun as a weapon, you know, that's fine, you can still pick it, but it comes with all this fictional baggage. People will see you as a coward. People will see you as being dishonorable. And that's something to apply here.
Mm-hmm.
Really think about what kind of sword people would be using around you. Like, if you're from, I don't know, some warrior culture where everyone uses those two-handed swords because it's like, you know, a sign of prowess that you can wield this giant thing, and you pick, I'm building a sneaky character, I'm going to use a short sword. Okay, fine, but then I think the GM, if he's made this, you know, clear to you, can then say, okay, and yeah, everyone's going to make fun of you, because not using an appropriate weapon. You know, everyone
given
thinks
out of a sword, then he makes a knife. Ha ha.
Yeah, exactly. Everyone's going to think you're small and weak, and yeah, that's role-playing opportunities there.
Yeah.
I think that'd be great.
And actually, you know, by the kind of sword that you carry as well, it can say a lot about what your fighting style is and what other people might think of it. Oftentimes, the swords that kind of have a thicker end to them, like the Greek coppice or like a scimitar, oftentimes those are used for people who have very little training, because the weighted end allows them to just get a better heft and a swing, and it doesn't have to be really accurate. It's just kind of hitting them with a sharp end. So if people see a sword like that, they might assume that you're peasantry or that you're untrained and you are just kind of a militia. Whereas if you carry a rapier, that's something that takes quite a bit of skill to use. So that's probably something important, or that you're rich.
Yeah. No, like you said before, when Lyle brought up like the Viking swords, where, you know, swords were kind of a mark of status, and certain people just kind of had like a bar of chipped iron that functioned like a sword, but really wasn't, you know?
Yeah.
Now, I think that's another use for skills, if the game has them, as you said, Chris, you know? Like, let players make that roll to say, he's or she has this type of sword, which means they probably are this kind of person, or at least have this status. And, yeah, I think that'd be great, kind of another use for a skill that might not get used that often.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and in some cinematic games, they actually allow you to, you know, somebody, you know, skews armor. And just the what Chris said about the rapier reminded me of this. If they have a rapier and no armor, yeah, it's like you can build that in mechanically. But also, yeah, that says sends a message to the person. And it's like you would be more inclined to attack like the knight in full plate, because the other guy is walking around in this dangerous world with almost nothing, almost like a gunslinger.
Hmm.
So,
or the alternative is, hey, we have like, what's this musketeer-looking guy doing leading an army of full plate knights? Wow. Yeah. But maybe he's really freaking good with that rapier, and he doesn't need the armor. Oh, we better watch out for him.
Or he's the guy that stays while the rest of them charge.
Well, yeah, all right, all right. If he stands at the back and he has a rapier, hey, maybe it's just a wizard with a sword, you know?
Yeah, right. And, you know, there's also different kinds of swords, too, that aren't used by fighting people. Of course, they are used for fighting, but the one I'm thinking specifically is the Indonesian, the Kris blade. And I'm sure people are familiar with this one. It's a blade that kind of is wavy, like maybe like a snake moving along a trail.
Hmm.
And it's one of my favorite swords. Apparently, the waving part of it, the thin tip allows it to go in well, but the wavy pattern gives it kind of a maximum damage as far as cutting open muscle and arteries and whatnot. So apparently back in the day, they used to infuse them with acids and poison when they beat the metal. So the blades were often toxic. So pretty nasty weapons. But anyway, about that, originally they were used primarily for the guards of the king and for priests.
Hmm.
So it was a weapon that priests would carry around and use for themselves. Eventually, it became a rule of I think Java was the main country where every person in Java needs to have one of these for personal defense. But originally, anyway,
does every other person has one?
Yeah,
I think that's a pretty good point. Like, you don't even have to have a sword as a weapon, even though that's what its kind of function was. It could be like sword as a mark of status, even though it's kind of not really intended to be used. I just said, like, mm-hmm. you don't really picture a cleric or a priest walking around with a sword, but mm-hmm. hey, you know, like in those fantasy worlds, if you have those warrior gods, like even if you are playing like a religious person, well, why not carry a sword? Because you're following a warrior god, and wouldn't that be like a cool symbol? Like if everyone in that order has a sword, even if you can't really use it that well. And then it becomes like another mark of your character, and people everywhere, if they know, you know, that order, then they would recognize your guy as being part of that organization.
Yeah, and that's a huge thing. We still have ceremonial sword customs. I mean, the U.S. Marines, when they're in their dress uniforms, they have swords. The leader of Malaysia, he always carried actually that same sword I was just talking about, the Kris blade, as part of his symbol of his office.
Was it still toxic, I wonder?
Probably not. I don't know. I don't think modern ones are made toxic.
Hmm.
But I'm not sure about that, yeah.
I wouldn't imagine if the ceremony swords don't have edges to them. I doubt if they would make them poison.
Probably not poison either, huh?
Yeah.
But, you know, that kind of goes into where a lot of swords would have ceremonial functions in addition to the real ones. The old long swords, one of the reasons that they are made with that perpendicular cross guard is so that they could be stuck into the ground and they would resemble a cross so the knights could use them to pray to on the battlefield.
Hmm. Or use a hammer.
Yeah.
Yeah, and in Japan, you got, what is it, the Daisho, you know, you got the two, the katana and the wakizashi.
Wakizashi.
Yeah, one is used to help kill yourself.
One is used to kill your enemy, one's used to kill yourself.
That's kind of cool. I mean, of course, you believe Musashi in that. Yeah, he did serve another function when they went to the two sword style, but.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, just that thing is like, you know, this is what, you know, it's for my enemy, this is for me. Kind of that idea.
This is for fight, and this is for fun.
Yeah. But I mean, that also could explain some sort of anachronism, why they would hold on to a certain type of sword, and that's the sword that the heroes use. And as we mentioned, like, last episode, like, yeah, some things just stay within the generation and just kind of stagnate, because they pass that sword on, you know.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of times, yeah, you look at, like, when you have the elvish culture, why do the elves have the most advanced swords, you know, if their culture just, like, kind of stopped?
Hmm. Yeah, that's a good point.
Why don't they?
I was kind of assumed it was because they could use magic. But
they plateaued a long time ago.
Hmm.
Humans haven't caught up yet.
Well, yeah. There's that answer, of course. But
if you're happy with that answer, as well, then go for it.
It was a rhetorical question, Chris. Come on.
Yeah. I didn't want you guys to answer. Crap.
So, yeah. But there's different things you can do with that, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So anyway, yeah, that's definitely something to think about when you're building up a character, is that most likely it's not that your sword is fresh off of the anvil. It's probably something that you've received from someone else, perhaps a family member or someone in your station or part of the military. Most likely your sword has a background to it, some kind of history. And that can be woven into your character as well. So it's definitely something. I mean, make your weapon important. Make it a part of your character.
You know, you saying that made me think it would be pretty cool to have a sword that was fresh off the anvil if everyone else has a sword with background. You know, like, if you're kind of playing in a setting where, yeah, most swords are handed down, you know, from family member to family member, and most swords do have a history, having a lack of history would be kind of interesting.
You always got to be different, Wayne.
I guess so, but, again, I kind of saw it as, oh, look at that guy with the no-name sword. He must not know how to use it.
That's pretty cool, yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, if you lose a sword, you're eventually going to need a new one.
True, true. But that's also something to think about in the game as well. You know, when I do D&D, whenever somebody receives a magic weapon, I always have them name the weapon to try and build a little bit of character into the sword. But, I mean, that's something you should think about. People train on these swords. They use these. This is their weapon, the one that they've learned to use, they've chosen to use, whatever. It's far too common in games, I think, where someone comes across a +1 scimitar and, oh, well, I'll just dump this one that I've been using my entire life and grab this new one. I feel that there would probably be more of a tangible benefit to using a sword that you're used to, you know the heft and the weight of, and you've been trained in, rather than just something new.
Yeah, I think games that kind of have, like, proficiency, like D&D, again, that's one way you could make swords important. Like, it is kind of, it's not really kicking the players, but if you made weapon proficiency much more narrow, you know, they say, you've trained with that longsword or that scimitar or that whatever, you know that sword, and yeah, others are similar, but unless it's like they were all churned out by the same forge, none of them are really going to have the same balance or heft, or none of them are really going to feel the same as that one that is yours. Yeah. So if you lose that one or if you trade up, I mean, don't give them like a huge penalty, but I could say, okay, you know what, you're not used to that sword yet, so you're not going to be as good with it, and they get some kind of small penalty.
I hear what you're saying, Wayne, but it also kind of counteracts if somebody is a sword master, or are they really a sword master with that one sword? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Or are they a sword master with that sword type? Or, I mean, there's certain things that are, I think, would be transferable.
Well, I think D&D does a good job of that, because you have a proficiency in swords, means you know how to use swords, and having a slightly different shape doesn't matter that much. But you can also go into weapon specialization, where you get especially good with longswords, and then going out of the longsword will take away the bonuses you get from that. So I think that is represented, but I think more in a role-playing sense than in a mechanical sense.
Right.
Yeah, GURPS has like categories of weapons that might be more in tune with what you're saying, Wayne, but still, it's a category. So, but I was also thinking one thing, just about the culture that maybe we didn't touch on is also the weather, and you know, like certainly because their cultures are next to each other, like the scimitar is just like a catch-all term for these curved swords that appear in all these different cultures that are all hot, and like bigger swords seem to appear in cultures with a bit colder. I mean, there's different reasons for that. You know, obviously, a short sword is more effective in a hotter climate when people are wearing less armor, as soon as you start caking on, piling on the armor. So obviously it becomes less effective.
And that's why scimitars have curved edges, because people are less likely to be armored, so the cutting edge is a more useful feature.
Cuts through cloth better?
Well, and skin, yeah.
So I mean, that's something that maybe that should bear in mind. And if you're going to do the Crusades and actually represent the Crusades, then you're looking beyond the equipment list. You're also then looking at the climate rules and how that affects the characters. And, of course, the amount of weight they have is going to have a huge bearing on that. But, of course, that's adding more complexity.
Yeah, just kind of what you said about, like, swords as culture made me think, like, why do we kind of, well, I mean, you kind of explained why we see the scimitar in certain cultures briefly. But, like, that, again, would be a real, I think, interesting way to bind a culture together. You know, okay, so using the example, let's say you do build a character from this sort of, you know, fantasy Middle Eastern inspired culture where everyone does use a scimitar like weapon, and you choose longsword because it's better in your opinion. Well, then would other people see you as part of that culture? Again, it's kind of,
I think I see where you're going with that, and I don't think that it would exclude you from the culture, but it would definitely make you stand out. I mean, if you see a bunch of armored knights walking by, and then one of them happens to have this big, like Sinbad-type saber on him, then yeah, he definitely stands out, and you might question, why does he have that? What's up with that? And again, that's more story. Yeah.
Yeah. Sorry, I didn't mean like the GM would rule that no, you can't be part of that culture. I meant it more from like an in-world perspective. You know, like, not saying, no, you're not part of that culture, but just would other people kind of see you as betraying your culture because you don't use the traditional weapon?
Well, I depends on the culture. If it's a culture that doesn't care about what sword you use, you know, I mean, then no. You know, if
in Europe,
they don't age.
In Europe, nobody would care, but in medieval Japan, probably.
Yeah, but I mean, also just if you're walking around with a motley collection of weapons, I mean that can be quite exotic and quite exciting, and to play that up and it's like associate certain weapons with. So if somebody does pick a certain weapon, and you're like, okay, but that's not really used in your culture. I mean, you can find it, but like, why do you have it? Mm-hmm. Because this would be the default weapon in your culture, or these are the selection you have to choose from. And if you choose something else, then where did you pick that up? I mean, it could be a family heirloom, but your blacksmith or weaponsmith wouldn't make it. So where did you find it?
Yeah,
I was just thinking of the beginning of that Orlando Bloom movie, Kingdom of Heaven, where they kind of have the motley assortment of people from all the different countries as that one kind of band. And, you know, during the fight scene, they all kind of do bust out different weapons. And, you know, that's kind of unique. You know, it showed that they came from different cultures and different lands because they were using different weapons and kind of had different fight styles. So I think that'd be kind of interesting and maybe a good way to show that.
Oh, definitely. I mean, yeah, it can be like, yeah, the gateway to the culture and just like a signal. Like too often, people don't spend a lot of time describing what their character looks like and the equipment they have.
Right.
But the big message that you could send is like, yeah, somebody who does have like the traditional orc sword with the elvish armor and the, you know, the dwarven helmet and the, you know, the southern shield. I mean, what does that say? He's like, maybe he's killed a lot of people. Like, yeah. Friends
or
and foes, yeah.
Yeah, or he stole it all, yeah.
Or he could have bought it all, yeah. But
he's a mid-level character, yeah. That was a theory of my friend's that he said, you can always tell someone who's a mid-level character, because low-level characters, all their equipment matches, because they buy it from the store. Mid-level characters, they get all these menagerie of different kinds of magical items and stuff, so they all look mixed up. And then super high-level scary characters, they start matching again when they can afford the good stuff.
but that's really good, because the motley person is like, if you are picking up stuff in dungeons, or things are being awarded to you because of, you know, great deeds that you've done, then it would be kind of like...
Mm.
Like a motley collection. They're not going to say, "Ooh, we've got something in powder blue because that would match best with what you have."
Exactly.
No, you say this is what we have. You know, here you go. You've done us a great service.
You look like a powerful hobo. Murder hobos, yes.
You look like a powerful hobo. No, again, just you saying that made me kind of think of swords, not as language, obviously, but I know I tend to think that a lot of times games don't play up like the language barrier or the culture barrier. And Lyle, you saying sort of swords as the sort of the key to the culture or a symbol of that culture. Again, I think that'd be really interesting. So let's say you do, you know, get rewarded with, I don't know, this elven sword for doing something. And then later on, you have to go do something with the elves again from a different kingdom. And what would normally be very difficult now becomes slightly less difficult because you can demonstrate or you can show off that sword that you got. And prove that you didn't loot it off a body, but...
Yeah, I was thinking, you know, it could be more difficult as a... Yeah, they wonder, where'd you get that?
Or that, you know? Either way, it impacting the story in a way where just, like, you know, more than just numbers on a sheet.
Hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
Or you could, like, you know how you have the ancient order of knights and everybody's forgotten who they are, but, you know, just, like, walking in with that sword then says, like, we're back?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I kind of bring up, I don't want to say classic example, but an obvious example is like somebody walks in with a lightsaber. You're like, whoa, are the Jedi's back?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Don't worry, Lyle. I immediately went to lightsaber too. Sorry.
Yeah.
Or maybe you just kill a Jedi and stole it.
So were they back and
in
now
which case
gone
you get
again?
Mad props.
They were back.
Oh, come on. They're only about 20 years from where they disappeared, so I don't see how everyone forgot about them.
I think everybody remembers.
I still remember them.
No, it's all the expanded universe stuff where it's like suddenly there's all these Jedi still alive and you're like, well, where were you during the rebellion?
You know? They were all pulling a Ben Kenobi, laying low.
Yeah,
they thought, right. You know, they thought they were the only one. Cut them slack.
Well, speaking of Jedi, and it kind of gets into, I guess the last thing we want to talk about is when you move swords into like a modern or a future setting. And how do you do that? Because, well, there's guns now. And sure you could do that. Well, like, people who use guns that are cowards, but a lot of people are like, well, come on.
In the modern age, man, that's a lot of cowards.
Well, wasn't that actually true, though? Wasn't when guns first came about, I've heard a story, I don't know its veracity or not, but apparently a bunch of people who used guns in a regiment, they pulled a knight down off of his horse and then surrounded him and then shot him full of holes. And it was the idea that these commoners were so just massacred this knight so hideously that for a while in, I think it was England, the gun was really looked down on as a coward's weapon.
Yeah, the longbowmen would, like, kill knights.
Yeah, pretty efficiently.
But would they do it, you know, would they pull him down off the horse and then fire the arrow into him right there?
No, they would just take out the, they would carry these little short swords and or long knives and then stab. Because why would you waste an arrow?
Very true.
Yeah. No, but I think that...
But anyway, getting back into the modern thing, yeah.
I think that gets into just, like, if you, like, swords in society or certain status symbol. And, of course, you know, the knights seeing their position being usurped on the battlefield by, you know, commoners with guns, and before that, commoners with longbows. Yeah, and of course they're going to try to do, you know, arrest it. In Japan, they actually did do it.
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
And then they gathered up all the guns and stopped making them, so...
Yeah, I believe when you told the story before, you said, that's enough of that.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, they were making pretty good guns. They had pretty good tactics in using them, and then it's just like once Tokugawa Ieyasu was like, well, I'm in charge now, so... You know, what's the most dangerous thing on the battlefield? It's actually the gun. Get rid of those.
Yeah.
And even before the gun, the swords weren't preeminent weapon on the battlefield. The naginata is actually supposed to be better.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, tie it all, make it all ceremonial and stat, you know, related status. And that's something you could do in the modern and the future. It's like, yeah, ceremony, ritual has brought the sword back. Another way to do it is a Death Stalker series, which is actually really good. By Simon Green, and they have a gun, but they take a long time to recharge. Mm-hmm. So, of course, somebody who's like waiting for the gun to recharge, if somebody else then has a sword in addition to the gun, then they just charge up and stab them. Yeah. So that's why people became good using swords as well and would carry swords in addition to these like guns.
So they almost kind of like rolled back time a little bit to, you know, the beginning of the musket where you had to, you know, front load or muzzle load everything, and that's why you had
a single shot kind
of
deal.
Yeah, I'm surprised though they didn't develop ranks of soldiers with those rechargeable guns. But I was thinking of Dune, where that's another way to bring the sword back, where, you know, people have those personal shields that deflect anything that's moving faster, you know, than a certain speed. So there was the whole school of fighting where, you know, you used a slow knife to penetrate the shield and get inside. And again, it's not a sword, but you'd expand that out to sword play.
Mm-hmm.
You can't change the speed of a bullet once you fire it, but you can teach people to swing not slowly, because then it wouldn't do any damage, but, you know.
Slow enough that it gets through the shield, yes.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I think that's really the trick. I mean, you have to change the way the technology or the way the world works in order to bring the swords over the guns. You can do it like Star Wars, where your sword is A, such a useful and powerful tool that it's worth having anyway, or B, can also block bullets or dodge them across. You can have the energy shields that bring them preeminent. There was a cartoon series ages ago that I don't remember the name of course, but it was where people could teleport. And so they could just dodge out of the way of bullets, but if you got right next to somebody with a sword, then it was a worthwhile weapon to have.
What cartoon series was this where you would like have people like cut other people down with swords?
I don't remember the name of it. It had it was this guy with like blue skin and orange hair, and I think everybody had blue skin and orange hair, and they lived like in kind of this computer-esque world. You could do it with superheroes too. If you have somebody who's fast enough to where he can dodge bullets, but he can also swing the sword that fast, then it becomes a workable weapon. Yeah. Or if you have somebody who's tough enough to take a bullet, then that's fine, because a sword inflicts a lot more damage than a bullet does.
Well, vampire is an interesting way to do it in that, like, if you cut off somebody's head, or Highlander.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
You have to cut off their heads to actually kill them. So you can shoot them, and you slow them down, but, I mean, that's still pretty effective. I mean, a bullet does a lot of damage, sure, but cutting off somebody's head is game over.
Yeah.
So it could be something like that, where they are virtually immortal, except for that. But yeah, you really have to work it, because there's makes no sense.
You do, but you know, swords are cool enough.
Yeah, there's battle lords of what, the 23rd century, and they have the sword saints, and you're like, yeah, I guess.
I'm surprised they didn't come up with the gun saints after that.
Have you ever seen that, Christian Bale?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
What, the Gun Saint?
It's called Requiem, I think, in Japan.
No, it's called Revolution or something.
Revolution?
Something with an R.
No, it has a few names. Sean Bean's in it.
Mm.
Which means he dies.
Well, yeah.
I don't want to ruin it.
Hey, it's no spoiler. If Sean Bean is in a movie, he dies.
Equilibrium is another name.
Equilibrium. Ah, yeah, that's the English title.
Yeah.
But that's really cool, the way that they handle that.
Yeah, they actually did a really good job with that, I think. I think that movie's pretty good. Yeah, they're called, they're clerics. They call them clerics, and they're top-ranking government agents. And, yep, they developed this, martial art using gun.
Yeah. They have all these different kinds of positions and moves that maximize the targeting and kill ability. Oh, it's just cool. Watch it. It's good.
So then you should do that with sword.
Well, when you
they do.
No. Like there's something there in that you got these guys clerics and they walk around with these pistols, but they take on guys with automatic weapons and things like that, which really is not, you wouldn't be able to do it. So what are they bringing or what do they get to kind of equalize that?
It kind of goes back to the image of the lightly armored or guy with no armor and that smaller sword. Who's ready to face you down or face down a much bigger, heavily armed and armored target. And yeah, what's he bringing to the table that he's going to step to you with that little short sword?
Yeah. Tenacity. Moxie. That's what he's got.
A cube die.
Yeah. A D4. It's like, oh, I guess you didn't have anything. I guess your Moxie's going to be on the ground in a sec. Well, that wraps up the first in our weapon series. We'll probably not do parters for future ones, but for swords, I guess it deserved the deluxe treatment, or as they say in Japan, the plus alpha treatment.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
One thing I forgot to mention is trying that potato karaoke sandwich, so I guess you'll have to tune in for the next episode to hear about that.
What'll that be? Weapons bellyache?
Weapons karaoke.
Potato sweats.
Hey, look at that guy stepping to you with a karaoke sandwich, man. What's he bringing?
Yeah.
So find out what this and all other things mean next time. Cool. All right, well, thank you for joining us again on Out of Red Hands. Check us out online at www.idledreadhands.com, outofredhands.com. You can listen to the episode right there on the website, or you can download it off of DriveThruRPG or stream it through Stitcher or iTunes. You can post a comment right there on the website. You can follow us on Facebook or Twitter, or you can join up and talk to us in the forums, or even just send us an email, because we always love hearing from all of you. And, yeah, see you next time.
Bye.
Bye.
DriveThruRPG. We average 9 new titles a day. That's over 60 a week. And we've got well over 15,000 RPG titles online right now. DriveThruRPG, the one true source for RPGs. Road and makes
Idle Red Hands, recorded in Kobe, Japan. See us online at www.idleredhands.com. Music provided by Tripod Jimmy, and the song was Roadkill. Hope you enjoyed it. See you next time.